The following is a Super Network production with Super Marcy.
I hold back a lot. If I didn't, I would be my dark half.
The terrible Australian Bee Jermaine.
Probably the most iconic moment is the blood coming out of the elevator. Definitely not in the book.
It contains coarse language.
What is going on? What?
Mature themes.
We all know that Stephen King writes bullies to the extreme.
Potential spoilers.
Spoiler alert.
Listener discretion is advised. Please find us at supermarcy.com and subscribe to us via Patreon at patreon.com/thesupernetwork. Enjoy.
G'day everyone, this is Bee Jermaine, aka The Terrible Aussie, and welcome back to episode 16 of the King Zone podcast, the podcast where we dive into the film and TV adaptations of the works of Stephen King. And with me, as always, is my lovely co-host, the one, the only, Super Marcy. Hello, Marcy, how are you?
Hello, I'm doing pretty good, thanks. How are you, Beto?
Oh, not too bad, thanks, Marcy. Looking forward to finally getting out of our little two-week lockdown, so...
Yeah, I know, right?
Yeah,
I mean, technically, it ended a week ago, but not a fuckload really changed, so...
Yeah, but at least we can actually see each other in person again, which is good.
Yeah, I mean, do I really want to see you? No, I'm kidding.
The savagery.
I know, right?
But, I've been good as well. Been busy with work and life in general, and also with June's exploitation, so that's been keeping me busy. But looking forward to tonight's show, because we have a lot to talk about, and we have two very special guests joining us.
Yes, we frickin' do. And we got lots to talk about, so, we can kick this mofo off.
Indeed, and with what makes tonight interesting, we have a returning guest, but also a first-time guest who has never been on our show before. We'll get straight to them. First up, of course, is a man who has been on many episodes of the King Zone podcast, and he is back here tonight to join us for some more Stephen King shenanigans, and that, of course, is the one and only Rob Hunter. Hello, Rob, how are you?
Hello, people of Earth. Thanks for having me back.
And how have things been going with you, Rob?
Well, I guess I'm sitting here looking out my window, and you know, who can complain about that?
Exactly. But where you are though, could it be the setting of a Stephen King story?
It could be. I mean, I'm in an area where I've got places called Portland and Vancouver and stuff like that. But it's not Portland, Maine. But it still is lovely outside, and I'm sure there are werewolves out and about.
Indeed. So we'll always have to be on the lookout for the werewolves. But next up, of course, is our first time guest, who's been a friend of the show for quite a while. And this is his first ever appearance. And he's also a writer for House of Geekery. And that, of course, is Josh Plock. Hello, Josh. How are you?
Hey, it's good to be on.
It's nice to finally to get you on the show.
I was just avoiding your messages all this time, but
I knew it.
Figured I had to bite the bullet and... Oh, I mean...
The silver bullet, you mean?
Wait, it was an option to avoid these messages?
only if they're from me, but if they're from Marcy, you have to accept or else she'll abuse the shit out of you. I should know, I get it on a daily basis. But anyways... But Josh, tell us, what has been going on?
Not too much over here. Really, really hot here in Memphis. Just unnaturally hot. I wish we had spooky werewolves and stuff like in Maine, because at least it'd be cooler.
Indeed. I can imagine so, because here in Australia it can be very hot, and especially here in Melbourne, not only can it be hot, it can be very humid, so... The combination of those two is always not fun at all.
Well, we're smack bang in winter and it sucks off.
Indeed.
I don't like it.
Indeed. But we'll get right to the show because we have a lot to talk about on tonight's episode of The King Zone, because we're discussing two Stephen King film adaptations and an anthology film that contains one of his stories. And, of course, we're going to be talking about the films Silver Bullet, The Running Man, and Tales from the Dark Side. So let's get right to it. First up, of course, is the 1985 film Silver Bullet.
It began in May. And every month after that, whenever the moon was full, it happened again. And again.
What was that?
It's over there.
Don't point that at me.
Nobody knew who or what was responsible.
Come on.
They only knew it had to be stopped. Now, from the master of mystery and suspense, Stephen King's Silver Bullet. Silver Bullet, the last glimmering hope.
Which was directed by Daniel Attias, with a screenplay by Stephen King himself, which of course is based on his novelette Cycle of the Werewolf, which also featured illustrations by Bernie Wrightson. And the film stars Gary Busey, Corey Haim, Megan Follows, Everett McGill, and Terry O'Quinn. And the plot summary, which I am reading off IMDb, is, in a small town, brutal killings start to plague a close-knit community. Marty Koslaw, a paraplegic boy, is convinced the murders are the doings of a werewolf. Now, Josh, since you're our first-time guest, tell us your thoughts on Silver Bullet.
Well, for me, it has a very, I guess, emotional part in place in my heart because it was one of the first adult horror movies I had. Like, up until then, growing up, the werewolf movies I know of, the Lon Chaney Jr. Wolfman movies from Universal. But this is when my dad goes, hey, for whatever reason, I was up past my bedtime. He's like, hey, I saw this movie on HBO one night. The Preacher is a werewolf. So for me, having grown up in the Deep South, going, wait, there's a werewolf and the Preacher's a monster? Oh, man. So I had to get in on that. And ever since then, I've just loved this movie like nobody's business.
Rob, tell us your thoughts on Silver Bullet.
Yeah, I've been a fan. I'm not from the Deep South, but I also dislike preachers. So I was happy with that denouement. But yeah, I've been a fan for a while. It's actually one of my, I mean, if I was ranking them, it'd be like in my top five werewolf movies. I think it's a fun, it's obviously not like an Amblin movie, but it has that feel. It's kind of like walking the borderline between, you know, a regular adult horror movie, but also kind of like a kid's adventure. And it does a good job, I think, with that. And so it's been one that I've always loved. It's fun. It's got some good, you know, werewolf action in it, some good suspense beats. Great actors, obviously, in there throughout it. And I just think it's a great precursor as well to something like It and something like that, where you can see King's voice, you know, with his family dynamic, with the siblings. The uncle, so like that, it feels very much, you know, in his wheelhouse. And then on top of that, like I said, it's just a solid werewolf movie. Great practical effects as well. So yeah, I've been a fan for a while.
Hey Marcy, what do you think of Silver Bullet?
I never watched it. No, I'm kidding. No, I think it's quite a fun film. I think it's very like King-esque. But I found it interesting because I did not realize that Don Coscarelli was originally the director on this film, and he did film some scenes, but then got frustrated and pissed off, and they got someone else to fill in. So I imagine it would have been a bit of a different film if, you know, he had done the whole thing, but you can definitely still see he's there with some scenes. But I think Silver Bullet is a pretty good film. It's very enjoyable. It's got a really good cast, and Gary Busey is Gary Busey, but not Gary Busey up to 100. It's Gary Busey at about 70, and I think it just works at the right way. definitely there's good, like, creature effects. The werewolf looks really cool, but definitely, like, Stephen King, the way he tackles different things, like, the way he sees a werewolf, it's just like, this is this monster, but, you know, it's attacking this town, but here are all the people in the town, here are all the characters, here's the dynamics of what happens when this event happens in this town. So I you know, it's always very fascinating because with him, it's very different. He's shown that he does werewolves different. He does vampires different. That's just who he is. Bede, what do you think about Silver Bullet? And do you want a wheelchair for when your legs might not work? That's called the Silver Bullet. So you can ride around town on your little, like, you know, it's basically like a motorbike almost.
Yeah, well, I mean, having grown up in, you know, a small town, one of the things I love about this film is that it really does capture small town life, especially in the first act of the film, which I think it did really well with, kind of establishing, like, who these people are of this community, like, what are their roles, how they relate to each other, and also the family dynamic between Corey Haim and Megan Follow's characters. Like, at first, they're, like, they sort of had this kind of sibling rivalry between the two of them, but as the story progresses, their relationship with each other starts to grow. And I do agree with you, Rob, that this film, in a lot of ways, and maybe, and also the story too, do have that sort of a feeling of it. That's what I sort of felt rewatching this film again. And also the stuff with the werewolf, I think, is really well done, because when the attack scenes happen, they happen so fast and are so visceral. It feels like something, like, if I guess if in any kind of attack, whether it's an animal or a human being, or heaven forbid, if you happen to run across a werewolf, it would be this kind of quick, out of nowhere kind of thing, and it would just happen so fast you could almost have no time to react to it. And I like how these scenes are done, the way that they're edited and shot. Like, we kind of barely see the werewolf, because it almost takes, for most part, a Jaws approach, where we only see bits and pieces of the werewolf for a while. And then, of course, once we see it in its full glory, we realize, oh, it's just a giant teddy bear. But anyways, let's just face it, as much as I do love this movie, the final werewolf design definitely is not the best, because it looks more like a bear than a werewolf.
It looks like a bear.
And you just want to give it more of a cuddle rather than be terrified of it.
Yeah, but let me say this too. I mean, you're saying it looks more like a bear than a werewolf, but I mean, werewolves aren't real. So,
oh, that's true.
I mean, who's to say what they actually are supposed to look like? I mean, I'm a fan of the design. I mean, obviously there are other ones where the practical effects, I think, are more elaborate and, you know, and laudable. But I mean, I feel like it's especially for what it feels like a little movie. I'm a fan. It's Carlo Rambaldi, I think, did the design. I think it's effective. So there.
Yeah. I mean, it's still effective. Effective regardless, despite how I personally feel about the design, because how it's used in these scenes is so well done and so intense that you do are legit terrified for these characters and what's happening to them.
So, and I love the basically, Bede, you think you want to go cuddle werewolves. You're just saying they look like bears, but I think you've got a bit of an attraction to werewolves.
I wish.
They're animalistic.
To be fair, like, if a werewolf did look like a teddy bear, that could be its trap to kill you, because you think it is cuddly, and then once it gets close to you, it just rips you to shreds.
I mean, this werewolf took out Lawrence Tierney, so we mortals wouldn't have a chance against it.
Definitely. I mean, if it could take out Lawrence Tierney, then there's no hope for any of us. But I gotta say, like, as much as I do love this film, I guess the one other aspect of it I do find flaw with, but I'm kind of curious on what you all think, is the vigilante scene. Like, out of all the scenes in this film, this one kind of felt to me like the one that felt like out of a completely different movie, because it felt it was very comical in how it was sort of approached and made. But I suppose, you know, that is Stephen King's style, and he always loves to show kind of the ridiculousness of specific characters and how they react to situations. So I can definitely see it on that front. But I don't know, I think compared to the rest of the movie, the tone just didn't quite work with me. But I'm curious to hear what you guys think.
I liked it because I'm a big fan of the old Universal monster movie, so I thought it was a nice little tribute to that. Plus, you know, you had a lot of good character actors in that crowd, so it was just fun seeing them going out there. And you got to give the monster something, somebody to kill and make them a threat. Oh, yeah, so, whole bunch of people at once. That was fun.
Yeah.
Yeah, I would agree. I mean, I think part of it, too, is that obviously the movie has a villain in the pastor, you know, slash werewolf, but mobs and, like, you know, that kind of a mob mentality, you know, group things are never, never, ever good. And so, especially in movies, it highlights that. And I think a king is someone who has always been someone to kind of, like, highlight that as well. Even something like The Mist, you know, when you get people kind of, like, bolstered by each other to move forward, you know, stupidly. And so he's kind of tackled that area before. And so I feel like that's similar to this, where he's just kind of highlighting, like, okay, a bunch of stupid people, you know, reacting irrationally. And then boom, yes, you know, like Josh said, you got, now you've got a higher body count. So I think it's helpful on both those realms. So even though it's silly, I think it's good as making fun of these, you know, idiots in the first place.
I can definitely see that for sure. But I think it, overall, like for me, the film is, like I said, it's just, I would say it is definitely one of my personal favorite werewolf films. Like, I don't know what it is about this film. Maybe it's kind of that nostalgic feel, the fact that it's kind of takes place in a small town. So in a lot of ways, I can relate to the film on that level. But I just
plus, don't be shy about your love for Corey Haim.
Yeah. Well, how could we ever forget Corey Haim? Like, he's really good in this movie, and I think he's a great protagonist. And the funny thing is, sort of like reading up, like, about the book, like, his character, because the book, what I think is interesting, and they do sort of replicate that here again in the film, is that it follows this town over the course of the year as it deals with this werewolf. So it's like different sort of stories each month. And the character of Marty only appears, I believe, in only two or three of the stories. So he's not really that part. He's not a major character in the book. But I like the fact that Stephen King and Daniel Attias, which this is his first and only film, they sort of really kind of had him as the focus, kind of seeing this whole thing from his point of view. And I think that, to me, with his character and also the family, are definitely the heart of the story. And also Gary Busey, who pretty much improvised all of his dialogue.
Yeah.
And going at his most Gary Busey-esque. Even his character's endearing, too. Like, you see he's a weird, wacky guy who wants to try to be the responsible one. But, of course, like, he sort of goes back and forth whether to believe, like, his nephew is seeing a werewolf, or is he just making it up. But I love that sort of dynamic between those two, but also just all three of them. And I think Megan Follows is really good in this film too. I think she's definitely one of the underrated MVPs of the film.
I actually think this is one of Corey Haim's best earlier films when he was still a kid. I think he's really, really good.
Holy jumped up ball-headed Jesus Palomina.
Uncle Red.
From him, I'd expect it. Sometimes I think your common sense got paralyzed along with your legs. But from you, Jane, you're Miss Polly Practical.
You don't understand.
I understand that my niece and my nephew are sending little love notes to the local minister suggesting that he gargle with broken glass or eat a rat poison omelet.
It came from me. I shot it in the eye. Now he's wearing an eye patch.
I wish I had a tape recorder so you could hear what you sound like.
What about the baseball bat Jane saw in a shed?
What about it?
You know who used to have a baseball bat like that? Mr. Knopfler.
So?
It looked like Bigfoot had used it for a toothpick.
You want to know what I think?
No. I just called you out here to admire your pretty little face.
You better watch your mouth right now. You're on thin ice with me, son. I think you had a hallucination. I think it's probably a broomstick or something.
It was not! Do you want me to show it to you? Come on, I'm not afraid. I'll show it to you right now.
No. I'm a little too old to be playing the Hardy Boys Meet Reverend Werewolf.
Jane, forget it.
Jesus, yeah, forget it. Werewolf.
Probably have gotten rid of it by now anyway.
This is the dumbest thing I've ever heard. Just forget it. It's crazy.
Like, some of the scenes are really hokey and silly.
Yeah.
But I think that just adds to the charm of the film. I really do. I think it's very... It just works, basically. And I do think Corey Haim is really good in this. And Gary Busey just improvising the shit out of stuff. It works in a weird way. It's almost funny, like, you kind of want him to be the werewolf at the end. But you know it's not. But you kind of just want that to see that.
Well, that would. Well, I got to admit, when I first, the first time I watched this movie, I hadn't read the book. Like, I wasn't sure what the story was going to be. I was actually legit shocked that Everett McGill was the werewolf, because what I also think is a credit to this film is, like, he's, like, for the first two halves of this movie, he's, like, in the background. And as an unsuspecting character, so you would never think, oh, a preacher character could be like a werewolf. And then when it actually happens and you find out, that's like was legit shocking to me. But I suppose when you have a scene of him having that really actually legit creepy dream sequence of him being in a church being surrounded by werewolves, I guess that would have been a bit indicator. But to be fair, I was quite young at the time.
That scene symbolizes that, you know, the church basically swallows you whole. Just saying. Symbolism.
Very much symbolism.
Yeah. But what was it? Did he have the eye patch in Twin Peaks, or am I dreaming?
I don't know. No, it was his wife who had the eye patch.
Huh?
His wife had the eye patch. Not him, personally.
When did he have an eye patch in something else?
I don't know.
Because I feel like I was seeing double when he had the eye patch. I don't know what it was.
In all fairness, he pulls it off quite well, so.
Yeah, exactly.
I think he's, you know, he was a terrific actor. I think he was almost underrated in a lot of ways, but yeah.
Oh, yeah.
Who else is going to be the werewolf other than the fucking preacher? Like.
Well, you could always have, like, Terry O'Quinn.
It's Stephen King. We know he doesn't. He's not a religious man. He has a lot to say about religious lunacy. So, you know, I think if you know King, you know that's gonna who it's gonna be.
Yeah.
Whatever I was saying, I don't even remember. Got, you know, a good performance from Corey Haim. And I don't know, if this film was made today, would people complain on Twitter and be like, why haven't you cast a kid who really needs a wheelchair? Definitely, you know, fate that way.
Yes.
Do you think they should have given work to someone who really had, you know, paralyzed with their leg? I don't know.
Well, I suppose. Like, I guess it's kind of really hard to say, but actually I've always been thinking about this for a while. Like, as much as I really enjoy this film, I think Silver Bullet could easily, out of all the Stephen King, like, works I've seen, read in that, I can definitely see this work as, like, making another adaptation of this story. Because I think
it's like, you know, what? A 12-part series. Right. Each month of the year. I'm just saying. Like,
yeah.
The book.
Yeah.
But Rob, please chime in.
And yell a bit.
I would disagree only because I think, one, they'd ruin it with CG werewolves. Two, I mean, it would just, this kind of thing, it is a very simplistic story that, like I was mentioning earlier, that kind of, you know, steps a toe into the Amblin realm, and you just don't really see a lot of movies like that these days. And so I think that a new telling of this, we either, you know, tip Marty a little bit older, so you can get the CW crowd, or it would just lean like fully into, like, you know, silliness. Whereas I think this one, it just strikes a really good balance between, you know, goofiness, sentimentality, and horror. And I just think that's not a combination that, you know, we'd be lucky enough to find most likely again. I mean, who knows? I mean, I'm open to all remakes because, you know, the original is still always going to be there. But this is one I don't think this one would necessarily improve in any way today.
I can definitely say that, yeah.
I wouldn't mind looking at the werewolf more if they redid it, because he was actually a malicious werewolf. Whereas usually with, you know, Lon Chaney Jr. or American Werewolf in London, they're, you know, oh, I'm so tortured, I don't want to be a werewolf. He didn't want to be a werewolf, but he also didn't have a problem running over a kid with his car or waiting until he was at his full werewolfiness in the full moon before he attacked. So he kind of liked being a monster. That'd be kind of fun to explore.
Yeah, that's another aspect of the film I really enjoyed too, is compared to other werewolf films, like you say, Josh, they're sort of more treated as these torturous characters, but this is one who was like, you know what, I actually kind of enjoy killing people as a werewolf, so...
Yeah. See, that is a very good reason why a werewolf should never turn me into one of them, because I would have too much fun. I'd be like, so, you wronged me on that comment section, you're my next victim, and tater shred. Like, it should not happen, for sake.
Oh, jeez.
I forgot where we were going with everything.
That's all right, though. But I guess we'll share our final thoughts on Silver Bullet. Josh, what are your final thoughts on the film and also your rating for it?
I mean, this movie was a big part of me growing up, and even now when I still watch it, I still really like it. I mean, the werewolf's no Jack Pierce or Rick Baker creation, but it still looks fantastic, so... I dig it. I'll watch it anytime it comes on.
And what would your rating for it be?
Out of five.
So.
4 out of 5. Solid nice. 4 out of 5.
Hmm. Nice. And Rob, your final thoughts and rating for Silver Bullet?
Like I said, I'm a fan. To Josh's point about being a nasty, mean werewolf, I also dig that. It's similar to something like Late Phases, where it treats the werewolf as a straight up monster and not, you know, somebody who's, you know, going through something. So I enjoyed that as well. Great characters, again, good fun. It's just an entertaining kind of like a kind of flashback to childhood. You know, I mean, again, just like those old school movies from the 80s, where just, you know, you, as a kid, you're out having these adventures that you look back on now and you're like, Jesus, I shouldn't have gotten away with that. It feels like that kind of experience and atmosphere. So I very much like it. If it was like a critical rating, I'd probably say like a 3 out of 5, but my own affection for it would push it up to a 4.
And what about you, Marcy?
I really enjoy Silver Bullet. I think it's a fun film. Like, you could imagine, like, Steven Spielberg could have adapted this.
Oh, yeah.
In a way. Like, I think that, you know, I think that's already been brought up. But, yeah, I think it's quite fun. It's very enjoyable. There's some goofiness in it, but... overall, I don't think that bothers me too much. I just think it's a really fun film. Definitely worth watching. It's such a different werewolf film, and it has this very different approach. As you mentioned, it's not like the tortured character who's the main, you know, character of the film. It's just this dude in the town is a werewolf. He probably kind of fucking likes it because he's been a preacher, and maybe he's taking out a lot of his repression as being a werewolf. But I would give it a solid 3.5 eye patches on the werewolf out of 5.
For me personally, I do very much love this film. I think it is, without a doubt, probably one of my personal favorite werewolf films. It just sort of strikes that perfect balance between sort of character, story, and scares. And like, when it can be very scary, it can be legit chilling as well, particularly when... some of the film's more violent moments, which I do appreciate. And, you know, it's just got great performances, great writing, and it's definitely one of King's best screenplays he's written for the screen. But yeah, I really, very much really like this film a lot, and if I had to give this one a rating, I give it about 4 out of 5 as well.
Nice.
What do you mean if you had to? You're the one asking everybody for a rating.
Good point. But we'll move right along to our next film, which is the 1987 dystopian action film, The Running Man.
In the year 2017, an innocent man accused of a crime has a choice. Hard time or prime time?
Sensational. Perfect contestant. I want him.
He must pay or play The Running Man.
On your mark!
I'll be back.
Go!
The highest rated TV show in history.
Guess they want us to stay.
It's a game between life and death.
You lift.
Arnold Schwarzenegger is The Running Man. He's playing for a prize. The prize is his life.
How about the life?
The Running Man.
Here's your Sub-Zero! Now played Zero!
I can't do that. Lol. That's not how you do it, Marcy. That's not how you
I
do it.
I can't, shut up. My impressions are, like, the shittiest.
And this film was directed by Paul Michael Glazer, a.k.a. Starsky from Starsky and Hutch, and was written by Stephen E. D'Souza, based on the novel The Running Man by Stephen King's pseudonym, Richard Bachman. And the film stars Arnold Schwarzenegger, Maria Conchita Alonso, Yappa Kotto, Jim Brown, Jesse Ventura, and Jesse Ventura's wig, and also Richard Dawson. And the plot summary for this film, which I am reading off IMDb, in a dystopian America, a falsely convicted policeman gets his shot at freedom when he must forcibly participate in a TV game show where convicts, runners, must battle killers for their freedom. Now, Josh, tell us your thoughts on The Running Man, and how do you feel that this movie accurately portrayed the events of 4 years ago?
Well, I know in my neighborhood we're still cleaning up after what Jim Brown did with the flamethrower. This movie was just plain cool. It's one of those movies like The Sweet Smell of Success or Highlander where it's just cool. And as a runner, like, I never noticed watching this growing up, but when I rewatched it for this podcast, Arnold did not skip leg day when he did this movie. Like, his quads were huge, so good job with the running. That, and I like Richard Dawson pretty much playing a parody of him, an evil dark side parody of himself from Family Feud. That was a lot of fun.
And Rob, what are your thoughts on The Running Man?
I'm not a fan.
Oh.
I haven't been a fan since I first saw it, and I just rewatched it this past week. I feel like it's too much of an Arnold Schwarzenegger movie. And like I mentioned, King's voice in Silver Bullet. There's not a single element of this movie that feels like King's voice. The entire thing feels like a kind of a generic sci-fi action thing. Which, I mean, I know it's similar plot-wise, is something we've seen a few times before and after. And I mean, it's got little bits of fun. I mean, I agree that like Dawson, I think, is good fun. But it's just so. Like, the cheese, I can handle cheese, but the cheese here doesn't really work. The action is never all that exciting. The characters are kind of dull. And I do dislike, this is like a little pet peeve of mine, but I dislike this kind of thing. Because, I mean, the audiences in this, like, I'm watching, like, in the movie, watching the show unfold, are just filled and riddled with assholes. You know, both the rich ones, the poor ones, they're all just assholes. Because they're all encouraging, you know, this murder and slaughter, having fun with it. But in the end, like, we're asked to, like, celebrate with them, and it's like, fuck off. You know, you guys are dicks. So, I mean, I feel like it's, you know, it doesn't really resolve anything or do anything. It just, you know, throws in some pretty weak action beats, terrible one-liners. And then ends. I don't know. Plus, also, if I'm being honest, it's a depressing movie because whenever I think of it, I think of Paul Michael Glazer's wife and child dying from the HIV blood transfusion. So it just depresses me. So, like, that weighs against it as well. But even without that, it's just kind of an uneventful, flat movie for me.
And Marcy, what do you think of The Running Man?
I kind of agree with both Rob and Josh. So, it is a fucking stupid movie. It's so full of cheese. The one-liners are fucking cheesy as all fuck. Like, seriously. This movie, on any other day, would just be like, this is kind of fucking dumb and shit. But I've always found a weird enjoyment out of The Running Man. It is what it is. I sit back, I watch it, I laugh. The pacing, I think, is a little bit off, but it does actually kind of feel like the length of the film. It doesn't feel like it's 5 hours when it should only be an hour and a half. It feels like an hour and a half, which I think is good. Arnold is just Arnold in this film. He doesn't give a shit. Like, the rest of the cast, like, they're serviceable. But it's just a big, dumb, stupid film. And I don't know, some of the kills are kind of fun in a way. I mean, as funny as that, he's your Sub-Zero, now plain Zero. Like, that is a stupid line. But when I rewatched it, I almost fell on the floor laughing at how fucking stupid it was. I kind of loved that. And Jesse Ventura's wig, fucking hell. It is so funny and bad, it works. And I have a lot of love for fucking Jesse Ventura. But, yeah, The Running Man is just a really fucking silly piece of shit that, yeah, I enjoy for whatever reason. Bede, what do you think of The Running Man? And do you think that in, like, a few months we're going to have a Running Man type of show where we have to battle in order to be able to get our fucking vaccine in this country?
I think we will, but we have to wear those skin-tight leotards that they wear in the movie.
Yeah, fuck no, I'm not going. I have curves. It's not pretty in one of those. No.
But, yeah, well, with The Running Man, I'm kind of, like, agree with a lot of what's already been said. When I think of 80s cheese, this is the film I think about. This film definitely is cheesy beyond level. And Arnold, I agree with you, Rob, that this is definitely not a King's, like, story. His voice doesn't even feel anywhere throughout this whole film. It is an Arnold Schwarzenegger film through and through. But on that level, it is pretty watchable and enjoyable, like, if you just watch it in that regard. And also, Arnold's one-liners are somewhere, like, between the brilliance of Commando and the terribleness of Batman and Robin, like, that middle ground.
Oh, no, this is Batman and Robin level bad.
Sub-Zero! Now, plain Zero!
Well, okay, I said correctly.
But also, Batman and Robin also is, I mean, like, that's that world, you know? I mean, that's a world where, like, you know, you've got Kapow and Blammo and stuff like that and Word Bubbles, and so it fits. Like, those gags and stuff in that movie fits. Here, it feels like, especially when you're weighing it against... Now, obviously, it doesn't get anywhere as near as dark as the actual novel. But it touches on some of the things, like, you know, people are hungry and people are broke and there's, like, a militant police state and blah, blah, blah. So there's some serious stuff in there. And so, like, just pairing it with that kind of dialogue, it just is like, it just doesn't work in unison, I think, for me at least.
I could definitely say that, yeah. But I mean, I still enjoyed it overall. I mean, it is very cheesy. It is very dumb. But I guess it's definitely a movie you just cannot take seriously at all. Even though it has a lot of interesting elements in it that are still very much relevant for today, like specific themes about misuse of the media and also how television is exploiting violence. And there's so many interesting things in this film, but, you know, it's kind of the same with any other dystopian story, so it's not really anything too new. But at least the movie, I do give it credit for at least kind of showing a bit of that, while also having some satirical elements as well. But at the same time, though, I can definitely see why this one is definitely getting a remake from Edgar Wright, because from what I hear, everything I've heard about the book, it is very much a much more serious book and a much more darker book, so it'll be interesting to see how he sort of tackles that compared to this film, which definitely, like, plays around with the cheese and the silliness of the story. But I think on its own, as like an Arnold Schwarzenegger vehicle, it's not one of his best, but I still quite enjoyed it. Like, it, I sort of took it for what it is, as just silly fun.
Yeah, I enjoy it, but I probably shouldn't.
Yeah.
And after rewatching it, I've forgotten, like, some of the lines are so just weirdly iconic. Like, when he's like, "Hello, cutie pie." And he's like, "I'm going to ram it in your stomach and break your goddamn spine." I can't do an Arnold, I'm sorry. But like, oh fucking hell, it's just stupid shit, really.
But my favorite line, my favorite line out of all of it was like, "What happened to Buzzsaw? He split, or he had the split." But yeah, once again, you know, I was actually legit shocked that Richard Dawson, who plays Killian, that's the thing, we have never got, like, American... What was it, Family Feud he hosted?
Yeah.
We never got that version in Australia, so we just saw him as, like, another actor, so we didn't realise it. I didn't realise till later that he was actually... He was a well-known game show host that they got for this film, and I thought as an actor, I thought he did a really good job as Killian.
Yeah, because apparently he's just playing, like, a heightened version of himself, and I think everyone on set fucking hated him or something, I read.
I don't think it was even heightened. I mean, if you're watching the episodes of those game shows, I mean, he's basically, like, just legit playing himself with the addition of, you know, sanctioning murder.
He took it upon himself to kiss the actual contestants on his real game show.
Yep.
So, I mean...
Yeah, that would not fly well today. but I'm just sort of very... It always puzzles me, like, that Paul Michael Glazer, Starsky from Starsky and Hutch, directed this movie, but he was, like, the fourth person attached to this film because they had a hard time nailing down a director for this film. Some only worked for only a few days, for a few weeks.
A hard time nailing someone. Thanks for that feed.
Ouch. A hard time sort of putting this film together because I know Andrew Davies was attached to this film, but he got fired after 2 weeks of filming. So it just kind of buzzes me out that he's the Glazer is the director of this film. But I think for the most part, I think the movie isn't badly made. Like if you told me like four different directors had a shot at this film, I wouldn't have believed you because I thought it was everything that was shot was felt very consistent with each other. But, yeah, I mean, some of the action sequences could have been a bit better. But that being said, though, I think it's because of the sort of the cheesiness and sort of the poor quality of some aspects of the story and action that kind of give it more of a guilty pleasure feel for me as a whole.
It also commits one of my other pet peeves in movies when you have, like, a commercial. So they show, like, the commercial as the show starts up, there's the commercial and it shows a bunch of scenes from the show. But all of the scenes in that commercial are stuff that hasn't happened yet. It's all stuff that's going to happen on that you know, tonight's live episode of the show. So it's you can't see the faces, but it's shots of like Schwarzenegger being dragged by the motorcycle or whatever, and they just edit it into this, you know, opening commercial, and that just bugs me.
Definitely. And also, like, how can, like, with certain areas that a lot of these like the runners and the stalkers are in, like, how did they get the cameras in there? I mean, I know they're everywhere, but still, like, you know, they're just, I don't know, it's just little plot holes like that.
What I feel like, it felt like it was just the same little bit of set reused over and over. I didn't feel like it looked that different. So I think if they kind of made it look somewhat different to everything else, I think that could have been a bit more visually interesting. Just saying.
Well, like, in this world, if you, like, even the supposed surveillance video of, like, Arnold gunning down people's helicopter and stuff had audio and multiple angles and stuff, so I guess they just have magic cameras in this world.
A wizard did it, Bede. A wizard did it.
Okay.
Anytime something doesn't make sense, a wizard did it.
That is true. That is very true.
Wizard. Now, this movie did have one of my favorite things I see in Arnold movies. I call it Incognito Arnold.
Yes.
He saw it in Jingle All the Way when he's Turbo Man, but he thinks he can just sneak through, like in this movie, it's the airport security and the Hawaiian shirt and everything, but how many large, beefy Austrian men do you meet on a daily basis that you would go, oh, He's another one. Okay, just wave him through. Like, you would think that would stand out.
He's a genius.
He's a master of disguise on John Cena levels, okay?
And he's also a master of stealth, as Commando shows.
Yeah.
Yeah, no one could fucking see him when he had all, you know, all guns blazing, because he had a bit of paint on him.
Exactly. But, Josh, what are your final thoughts and rating for The Running Man?
I mean, as Rob mentioned, as a King adaptation, I've never read the source material, but you couldn't, if you told me this is a King adaptation, I would call you a liar if I didn't know better, but it's just a good, fun, cheesy 80s sci-fi action movie, so I'm always game with that. I give it a 3.5 out of 5.
Nice. And what about you, Marcy?
I give this 3 Jesse Ventura wigs out of 3. it is not a good, like, a good or great film, whatever, by any means. I just find it enjoyable on a very weird level. It's so stupid and cheesy, but you know what? I can sit and watch it, and it's fine. As an adaptation, like, yeah, again, you wouldn't know this was based on anything Stephen King wrote, even under his pseudonym. But yeah, no, it's just big, stupid shit. It's fine by me.
And Rob, your final thoughts and rating for The Running Man?
I think if people hearing about it makes them go pick up the book, then it's a win, because the book is just I think a really solid piece of dark, mean, I wouldn't even call it entertainment, but it's just a mean little book. It's more than a little cynical. It's well worth the read, and so I'm looking forward to the remake. As far as this movie goes, it just doesn't really work for me, so because it's competently made, though, I'd give it like a 2 out of 5.
Yep. I would give it about 3 out of 5 myself. It is definitely not a quality film by any means. It can be incredibly stupid at times and very silly and very cheesy. I mean, when you have Jesse Ventura wearing that wig, like, you know what type of film you're in for. I'm just obsessed with his wig. I don't know what it is. It just does not look natural.
Be honest, you want that fucking wig.
I do want that wig. As a man who's balding, I need that wig. Exactly. But but despite that, though, I think I still enjoyed it nonetheless because of those same elements as well. It is definitely, probably, without a doubt, one of the... I mean, Arnold has starred in quite a number of cheesy films over the years. But this is definitely up there as probably the top 3. But I think it's, compared to others, I still think it's still quite fun if you take it for what it is, as a silly, cheesy, dystopian action film. But like Rob, like I'm definitely curious to see how Edgar Wright tackles the remake, because Edgar Wright has been known to make sort of more, you know, sort of comedy slash horror, sci-fi action. So him doing sort of a much more darker story is very intriguing to me, and I'm curious to see how he handles that. So, but overall, for this adaptation, it's a cheesy but fun time. So 3 out of 5 for me.
And I guess when the remake is out and we've all seen it, we'll all come back and review it for this show.
Definitely.
Because this show never stopped, because Stephen King adaptations are going to still be happening when I'm 100 years old in the old folk home and I'm still recording this podcast.
Yes. Exactly. Yeah. But before we get to our third and final film, a word from our sponsor.
The Super Network is proudly sponsored by Surfshark VPN.
Why would you have a VPN in this day and age? Well, a lot of people are quite concerned about tracking and their online privacy, and using a VPN ensures that you are safe and secure online. Surfshark VPN provides a lot of extra added layers of security, as well as ad blocker and a kill switch if your information is ever compromised.
A great bonus feature with having Surfshark is something is not available on your streaming service in your country. You just pop on that Surfshark VPN and you can probably find so much more streaming in different countries. If you want to find something like Masters of Horror, it is available on Tubi, so just select the correct country and you'll be able to watch such a great and fantastic show.
Surfshark VPN is one of the most reliable and cheapest of the VPNs out there, with up to 81% off offer when you subscribe for 24 months. Please use the link get.surfshark.net/SHR0 to take advantage of this amazing deal.
You can also find the link in the show notes.
Thank you, Surfshark. Surfy shark, do 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 do. Surfy shark, do 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 do.
And now back to the show.
And we are back. And our next film, which we'll be talking about, which is not a full straight-up Stephen King film, mainly because only one of the three stories in it is actually based on his work, but we're going to still talk about it anyway because it's a cool little film. We're going to be talking about the 1990 anthology horror film, Tales from the Dark Side.
Stephen King, originator of Pet Sematary. Arthur Conan Doyle, author of Sherlock Holmes. Michael McDowell, creator of Beetlejuice. George Romero, director of Night of the Living Dead. Now, these four masters of everlasting horror bring to the screen four tales of overwhelming terror.
I warned them, but they wouldn't listen.
Tales of diabolical fate.
You promised you'd never tell! No!
Tales of ghastly revenge.
Grow, O light. Rise, O light. Come forth, O light. Open his eyes.
Tales of ruthless evil.
That cat has killed three people in this household.
I don't believe this.
Kill it, bury it, and bring me its tail.
Tales from the Dark Side.
Well, that just about takes care of that, doesn't it?
Come, live the nightmare of your choice. Tales from the Dark Side. The movie.
Which was directed by John Harrison, which has segments written by Michael McDowell and George A. Romero, which are the first story being adapted from an Arthur Conan Doyle story, the third being an original, and of course the second story being based on a story by Stephen King. And this film stars Deborah Harry, Christian Slater, David Johansen, William Hickey, James Remar, Ray Don Chong, Steve Buscemi, Julianne Moore, and Robert Klein. Oh, and Matthew Lawrence as well. We don't want to forget him. And the plot summary for this film, which once again I'm reading off IMDb. A young boy tells three stories of horror to distract a witch who plans to eat him. Now, Josh. Now, we'll be focusing mainly on the second story of the film, which is Cat from Hell, which of course was adapted from a Stephen King story. But before we do, what are your overall thoughts on Tales from the Dark Side, and also, what did you think of the first and third stories?
Well, I was a fan of the Tales of the Dark Side TV show firsthand, so it wasn't until a little while later that I found out, oh, they made a movie out of it? So, I kind of did it in the reverse order than most people did, but I really like the first one because of the cast, because Christian Slater's great, and Steve Buscemi's great, and the third film I really love, because ever since The Phantom, I've had a man crush on James Remar. And I love the random gargoyle demon who appears to him and kind of holds that hold over him all his life until he thinks it's safe and it's not. I just thought that was so amazing.
Awesome. And Rob, what did you think of Tales from the Dark Side overall, and particularly the second and third segments?
Like Josh, I mean, I was a fan of the original TV show. I think it's one of the better horror anthology shows out there that doesn't really get as much love as it deserved. But as the movie goes, I mean, I think it's fine. I think the best story is the third, The Lover's Vow. I think it's just the best one all around, from the acting to the story to the effects. It's just a really solid little tragedy, I guess. It's great. The first one is what it is, I guess. as a whole, I think it's an okay anthology movie. I do think it's one that would have benefited from a fourth story, because I do think that each of the three, the first two anyways, run a bit longer than they need to. And so I think another story in there would have helped. You know, you would have been able to shorten them down a little bit, which would have improved pacing. And that the one that suffers the most, I think, is the King one, The Catch from Hell. I think that one feels notably long. But other than that, like I said, I think it's a solid movie. I think it's, I mean, it's no Creepshow. It's closer to like Creepshow 2, which is fine.
And what about you, Marcy? What did you think of Tales from the Dark Side overall and the second and third stories? But what's interesting, though, this is your first time actually watching the film.
Yeah, I had never seen this before. I have not seen Tales from the Dark Side, I don't think, the TV show. So this was my first foray into this film, and I thought it was fine. I enjoyed watching it, but I think I agree with you, Rob, that probably a fourth story, with the other ones being somewhat shorter, to fit a fourth one in there probably would have worked. And I know that this is kind of like the spiritual Creepshow 3, and definitely feel that. The first story or segment, I was like just taken aback because, okay, like Christian Slater, great, love him. He was one of my first crushes ever. But then like Steve Buscemi shows up, and dude, I always picture in my head Steve Buscemi as like a middle-aged man. And even here, I'm seeing him as a middle-aged man and he's like meant to be in college. I'm like, this is weird for me. and it's funny that like this was like what Julianne Moore's like first role or something.
Yeah, it was her film debut.
Yeah, like easy. Like the first story, yeah, it's fine. I didn't think it was too bad. The final one I thought was really, really good. Like that kind of story I could see done as like, you know, you could have seen something like that, but probably, you know, obviously made later on. Like that could have been a massive horror episode.
Oh yeah,
it's definitely got that feel that would have worked on that platform. But I thought it was definitely interesting, very well handled, and you know, a younger James Remar, fuck, hello. that man is still sexy. I'm just saying. you know, yummy, but whatever. I like that we had sort of something very different with a monster being like a gargoyle. Something I don't think we see too much. But as for the King story, that I think it was Romero did the script, right?
Yeah, Romero did the script. Mm.
All right. So first off the bat, it feels like a King story. It feels like it's from Romero. But having had kittens for a little while now, the brutality towards the cat, and I don't care if that cat fucking murdered your whole family. Don't fuck with the cat. Don't want to kill the cat. I didn't like that. It's so hateful towards cats. I'm like, it really took me out of it. And I just don't know. I didn't particularly like the story that much. I like that the cat fucking killed them all at the end, and it is fucked up when that cat goes right into that dude's mouth and basically destroys him from the inside. And as I said before, that dude fucking ate a pussy. Jesus. But I thought that segment, probably the weakest one, and maybe it's because I love cats so much, I didn't particularly like it, even though the cat wins at the end. But the dude, like, going, I'm gonna snap its neck. I'm like, I'm gonna fucking snap your neck, you little cunt. That's how I felt watching that film. But yeah, Bede, what are your thoughts on Tales from the Dark
Side? How do I follow that?
yeah, how do you follow that?
Well, I enjoy Tales from the Dark Side. I've never seen the original TV show, but I've always known of it. But yeah, I want to check out the show now, definitely.
You know, something we can definitely cover
on
at some point.
And definitely. But overall, I really enjoyed it. I would say it's up there as one of the best anthology horror films that I've seen. Like, overall, it's just solid, nothing more, nothing less. But I will say, though, compared to other ones, at least the stories are at least consistent in quality. I wouldn't say there's like what I would say is all out bad, like it would be with other anthology films. I think the wraparound segment with Debbie Harry and
Mention the wraparound segment. Fuck hell.
Don't worry, we'll get back to that. But I really enjoyed the wraparound segment. I think Debbie Harry as this sort of like cannibalistic witch was a lot of fun in that role, even though it's kind of a small role compared to the other stuff that happens in the film. But the first story, I thought was okay. Like, it basically is a slasher film, but with a mummy. And so on that grounds, it's okay, because I feel like they could have done that a little bit later. I mean, a little bit better. And also, I felt like the pacing of that one was a bit shaky at times and could have easily been condensed down a little bit more. But it's worth it just for, you know, seeing, you know, a young Christian Slater, Steve Buscemi, and Julianne Moore in this segment, because they were all really good in this part. The third segment with James Remar and Ray Dawn Chong, I really like that as well. I think it's definitely one of the probably the best segment of the whole film. And it is a much more of a tragic love story more than anything. And they're both really good in it. And also the gargoyle design is really well done, particularly, and spoilers out there who have never seen this movie, you find out that Ray Dawn Chong is the gargoyle. Once that sort of revelation is revealed, the transformation sequence is so brutal. And it almost is like, and I'm surprised not that many people talk about this sequence. I mean, and because it almost is just as good as, I mean, almost just as good as like the transformation sequence of the werewolf in An American Werewolf in London. Just how the special effects of this scene were done were just incredible.
Really well done. Yeah, I agree. Like the design of the gargoyle was really, really good. But that transformation, I thought, you know, especially for like back then as well, like, and, you know, this probably didn't have like the biggest of budgets. It fucking looks great. They did a really good job.
Oh, yeah, definitely. And I guess we'll get to the proper Stephen King adaptation of the story with Cat from Hell. Now, we already heard your thoughts on it, Marcy. But Josh, what do you think of the segment Cat from Hell?
It really, because it's the King Romero collaboration, and it felt very Creepshow-esque, and I can't really put my finger on why it did. I don't know if I knew it was those two together, but it was fun. I enjoyed it. The whole the cat in the throat thing was just awesome.
Those effects are really good too.
Oh yeah.
It's brutal. You feel every bit of that. It's like, fuck.
Oh yeah, definitely. Rob, what do you think of the segment Cat from Hell?
It was actually intended to be part of Creepshow 2, but they had to cut it. So I mean, I don't know how far along the production it was a part of it, but it was intentionally part of it, and originally, anyways. Like I said, I think it's to me it works best as for the visuals. I do think it stretches on too long for the story being told. I've got two cats and I love them, but I also feel like this hitman, if he was worth his salt at all, he could have like easily taken that cat out multiple times. So it's just like at a certain point, you're like, well, wait a minute, this guy's actually a pretty shitty hitman. But it's worth it for the obscene. I mean, it's the money shot is the end where it comes out of the guy, or after it goes in, it comes out of him again. So that's makes it a solid piece. I just do wish that it was trimmed down a little bit, again, to make room for a fourth story. But on its own merits, I mean, it's an interesting little piece. And as far as, like I said, you know, targeting cats, I mean, there are plenty of movies about, you know, like villainous or evil, not even evil, but, you know, like menacing, you know, animals, whatever. So I'm always okay. And I do love animal attack movies. I'm a huge, stupid fan of them. So this, even though it was like a short, you know, version of that, I'm still down with it, especially again with that ending. So I like it. I just wish it was shorter.
Yeah, I could definitely see your point. Like, I think I do agree with you, Rob, in the sense that there should have been a fourth story involved, because I think, like I was saying before with the first story, which I lot 249, like that one I feel like was a little bit too long for its own good, hence why I had sort of pacing problems with it. I didn't feel that as much with Cat from Hell, but I do agree if it was shorter, it would never have bothered me at all, because this is the type of premise that would have just worked as, say, a 10-minute short rather than half an hour as most of the stories are in this film. But overall, I really enjoyed the segment too, and I do agree with you, Josh, that it does feel very different from the other stories, maybe because like it seemed like John Harrison, who I thought did a really good job directing-wise throughout this whole film, and made each of the segments feel distinctly their own in terms of their style and their tone. But what I really liked what he does with Cat from Hell is that he kind of directs it. He must have knew, like, this was originally meant to be in Creepshow 2. I mean, he was involved with the other ones in some capacity. So I think in this one, it's almost as like, you know what, since this was originally meant to be a Creepshow story, well, Creepshow 2, I should say, you know, I'll direct it in the style of what George A. Romero did in the first film. So there's a lot of sort of bizarre camera angles, and also the flashback scenes have a sort of shot in a sort of a blue tint as well. And also there's a lot of Dutch angles as well. So it does have that sort of comic book flavor in terms of how it's directed.
In here, Mr. Austin. In here. I want you to make a hit. That is what you do, I understand.
How did you get my name?
Mr. Saul Loger told me that you know him.
Who do you want to hit?
Your victim is right behind you.
I ought to kill you for that. I don't like jokes.
I don't make jokes. Sit down. Here. Sit down, Mr. Halston, and look in that envelope. $50,000. There'll be another 50,000 when you bring me proof that the cat has ended its time on Earth.
I don't believe this. You're hiring me to kill a cat?
But I love the scenes where we actually do see a lot of the action from the cat's point of view as well, especially when he does attack David Johansen. And also his frustration, like him thinking like he's this great hitman, but of course he's being completely underestimated by this cat who basically is just showing him up at every turn. But and I do agree with you, Marcy, like the cat is definitely not the villain of this story. This cat is almost like a specter who is here to destroy these people who have basically ruined other people's lives, and so basically it won't stop until it has everyone. And yeah, I think the story handles that really well. Well, like, it is a very silly story when you think about it, because it's, like, literally a hitman hired to kill a cat. But I think George A. Romero and John Harrison, they do such a good job with how they execute the story. And it's a fun little segment as well. It's definitely the second best one for me overall. But I do agree, like, it could have been better if it was trimmed just a tad.
I reckon they could have easily shaved, you know, 7 minutes off every single one of these.
Yeah.
But, you know, again, I'm way too sensitive when people are assholes to animals in films because I love animals so much. But I fucking, the second I met these characters, I'm like, I hope that cat fucking rips out your eyeballs and eats them and fucking just scratches up your piece of shit face, because I just wanted them dead straight away. I'm like, you hate-filled motherfuckers, fuck off. I'm siding with the cat 100%. But it is really weird because as we've, you know, recording this and being in Dreamsploitation, I had just watched Lucio Fulci's The Black Cat, which also had a very malevolent, evil cat. But at the same time, I was just like, kind of siding with the cat. You fuck up those motherfuckers. So, but if I could just mention the wraparound story, which I thought was quite interesting. It was like almost like a Hansel and Gretel type thing where the witch captures them, is going to eat them. And he's kind of stalling for time by reading from the book that she gave him to read, and I don't fucking know why she would have given him a book to read, but anyway, Debbie Harry is great. I fucking always have loved her. Matthew Lawrence, I think, you know, as a kid, he was a pretty solid actor, but I just found his character so annoying. I'm like, can you just fucking cook that kid and get him out of this movie? Like, fuck off.
That's absolutely how it should have ended, though. I mean, it should have ended with her eating the kid.
Yeah.
It would have fit the tone of what the movie was and what the show was. And so I really despise that ending, especially when he looks in the fucking camera at the end, too.
I know.
That, to me, is the biggest misstep in the movie. The movie's fine. The stories are, you know, variations of fine, but that wraparound absolutely should have ended with that kid being eaten.
Oh, yeah. From the start, I'm like, can you eat this little shit already? I would have loved to have seen, like, you know, the dinner party with them devouring the kid. Like, that film should not have had a happy ending. Like, fuck off.
It still would have been a happy ending.
Exactly. Like, you know, for me and you, that would have been a happy ending, right? Like, that kid, fuck off, kid. For the record, I don't condone that adults eat children for dinner. I'm just saying, in terms of the story and the film, that's what should happen. It's like, fucking annoying.
Oh, jeez.
Just had to.
I'd rather than not have that wraparound and instead have the creepy narrator voice guy from the show.
I mean, I
think that would work better.
Yeah, well, I think I read somewhere, like, looking up info on this film, or I think it was actually John Harrison's idea to do the wraparound segment so that it could at least be in tone with, at least on a spiritual level, both Creepshow 1 and 2, rather than have someone who comes in as a host or narrator and introduced all these stories.
I do like wraparounds in anthology films. I mean, when they're done well, I think it adds a lot, and it kind of does work as the cohesive glue across the way. That said, I do agree with Josh that the opening narration from the show is like all-time opening narration, so I wouldn't have minded some of that as well.
No, it was pretty good, though.
Yeah, that just makes me want to go watch the show now.
Yeah.
We'll probably have to at some point, because I know a lot of Stephen King's stories were adapted for the show, so at some point we'll probably tackle those.
I think they did one or two, but I was going to say of the segments in this movie, it is The Cat from Hell that I think comes closest to the feel of the show, because the show was always also super low budget, but it was also had a little bit of, I mean, the episodes were rarely, you know, dead serious. They were, for the most part, always had a little bit of a wink and a nudge to them. And so I think that's the Cat from Hell story definitely is the closest to the feeling of the series.
I imagine so, yeah. But what's interesting, though, because we could have, like, back on when we were talking about Creepshow 1 and 2, I did talk about on that in the Creepshow 2 segment that, of course, that movie was originally meant to have 5 segments, and, of course, the fourth one, of course, ended up. Cat from Hell ended up being used in this film, but originally there was going to be a Tales from the Dark Side 2 that was actually going to adapt the other unused story from Stephen King for that film, which of course was Pinfall, and it was going to adapt another story of his called Rainy Season, but unfortunately I think there just wasn't really that enough, like, even though this film did well when it came out, it only did moderately well, so they decided not to go ahead with a sequel. So, yeah, we could have had that other story in Tales from the Dark Side too, but sadly it just wasn't meant to be.
I think this film's pretty solid. I quite enjoyed checking it out, to be honest. Fun first time watch for me.
Yeah, but Josh, what are your final thoughts overall on Tales from the Dark Side, and particularly Cat from Hell? And also you're ready for it too.
I'm always a sucker for a horror anthology movie. I mean, this was no Dead of Night, but it was still solid. Was it Lover's Vow? Made sure it ended on a bang. Cat from Hell, it wasn't my favorite, but I really enjoyed it. It was good fun.
And your rating for, like, your rating overall for the film?
We'll say 3 out of 5.
Nice. Rob, what is your final thoughts on Tales from the Dark Side, particularly Cat from Hell, and also your rating overall for the film?
Okay, one thing at a time, Bede.
That's not how Bede operates, mate.
I don't operate. I don't operate.
It's a solid anthology film. I mean, there's no stinkers in there. It does run a bit long. Each segment does. So it really could have benefited from a fourth one. But who knows? Maybe that would have been the stinker. So, you know, whatever.
Yeah.
I do think that Cat from Hell is probably, I mean, it's not probably, it's my second favorite episode or segment of the movie. Because I think Lot 249 is fine, but it's very, very straightforward. Like, there's no real element of, like, you know, like, suspense or anything to it. Just, you know exactly what's coming, and it happens, and then it ends, and okay, cool. Second one, Cat from Hell, it is fun. again, over long, but I think there's fun to it. It does have phenomenal practical effects with the cat going in and out. So I'm team that. That's good. Plus, William Hickey gets killed in the end, and I'm always team that as well. and then the last one, I mean, like Josh said, I mean, Lovers of Hour, I think, is pretty fantastic. It's the one that hits. It's entertaining, but it also just it's the one that actually hits, you know, in the gut. Plus, great practical effects. So it's definitely the one you want to end on. And then the wraparound fucks it all up. But yeah, other than that, solid anthology, unremarkable, 3 out of 5.
And Marcy, what are your final thoughts on the film overall?
Yeah, I thought it was watchable. I enjoyed watching it. They're all very solid, you know, stories. I think the first one, you know, it's all right. It's fine. The King one, yeah, it's fine. I just want to kill those motherfuckers so bad. I thought the third one might have been my favorite one. I just thought it was really different, really, really interesting. And again, like young James Remar. besides that, like I would give it 3 out of 5. That dude eating the pussy.
Sorry. Luckily, I wasn't drinking water just then. But
you scored it, and that's a success in my book.
Exactly. Yeah. But I guess for me overall, I really enjoyed Tales from the Dark Side. I think it's a pretty solid all-round horror anthology. It wouldn't be up there as one of my favorites, but it's still a pretty solid, fun movie nonetheless. And it's an easy watch as well. So, and also, like, it's probably one of the rare ones where each segment is pretty solid and there's no full-on bad ones compared to other ones that are out there. And the wraparound segment I thought was solid too, and I do agree with it could have ended on a much darker note. But Lot 249, it was definitely the kind of the weaker story, but it was still fun. If you kind of watch it as basically a slasher version of a mummy story, and also having this cast in it definitely makes it very watchable as well. Cat from Hell definitely is one of the best segments of the story. I think this one was darkly hilarious, really fun, and just seeing this cat just go at these really horrible people in really gruesome and disgusting ways, and of course the visual effects in this scene in this segment are phenomenal. And also finally Lover's Vow, which is definitely the perfect segment to end on because it's definitely the most dramatic and also tragic of the stories. And James Remar and Ray Dawn Chong both give great performances in this one, and also the gargoyle effects in this segment are just truly incredible and should definitely be talked about more. But overall as a film, it's a lot of fun. It's well directed. It's got some strong performances, and yeah, it's just a solid all around anthology film. So I give it about probably 3.5 out of 5 overall. Yeah, I guess that will be a wrap on this episode of the King Zone podcast. Thank you, Marcy, for always being a great co-host, as always. And thank you to both Rob and Josh for coming on the show and talking about these free movies.
Thank you.
Had a blast. Thanks for having me.
You're welcome. You're welcome. Marcy, where can people find you on the internet this week?
They can check us out at our base of operations at supermarcy.com. You can give us a like on Facebook if you want to keep up with everything that's going on at facebook.com/thesupernetwork. And if you would like to check out our Facebook group, it is facebook.com/group/thesupernetworkgroup. And we have monthly polls for our fan voted commentaries, which is always a lot of fun. You can scope us out on Twitter at twitter.com/sm_supernetwork, or you can follow me on Twitter at twitter.com/supermarcy. You can always find us on the Instagram at the.super.network. Find us on TikTok at supernetwork. I can't remember what any other socials we have, but we are on like YouTube. You can check out like all the weird, cool video series Bede and I do over there. And you just search for the Super Network or Super Marcy or Bede. We should show up there because I don't think we have like an actual like just YouTube.supernetwork, and it's got all these like letters and numbers and it's confusing, but it's all in the show notes, so check the show notes. And I think that's it. You can find all our podcasts on all the major podcasting platforms with Spotify, Apple Podcasts, Deezer, Google, Stitcher, just search whichever podcast you want to look up, or look up the Super Network, Super Podcast. It's all there. Over to you, Bede. Where can people find you if they want to tell you you're a dickhead?
Which they can do on a daily basis. But
I mean,
but if they want to find me personally so they can call me a dickhead.
dickhead.
They can find me at my Twitter page at twitter.com/BeeJamite, or my personal writer's page on Facebook at facebook.com/TerribleAussie. And of course, you can find all my writings over at supermarcy.com with all my reviews and columns. And Rob, where can people find you on the internet this week?
I'm on the Twitter at FakeRobHunter. My main home for writing is Film School Rejects, One Perfect Shot. I also occasionally show up for columns over at Slash Film, and that'll do you.
And Josh, where can people find you on the internet this week?
I'm on Twitter at Josh. You can find me at Josh the Angry Dinosaur. I have a bunch of articles that came out on the houseofgeekery.com, so feel free to check them out. Also contributed to the book The American Villain, which is out now from ABC CLO Publishing.
Awesome. Well, that'll be the end of this episode of The King Zone. Once again, thank you to all our listeners for listening to this episode, and of course to Marcy, Rob, and Josh for talking about these free films with me. And we'll see you all later. See you, everybody. Bye.
Bye.
Best one for last, didn't you?
No. I saved the really, really best story for now.
Well, you should have told me the really, really best story before, because now it's too late.
It's the really best one of all because there's a happy ending. A really happy ending. Love happy endings.
Okay, everybody. My name is Michael E. Cullen II, and with me is
Matthew Haas.
We are the co-hosts of the All Too Real 2 podcast. On All Too Real 2, we tackle pop culture topics such as watching and reviewing direct-to-DVD sequels.
We review any and every all direct-to-video movies of all time.
That we review so you don't have to.
Yeah.
We also cover pop culture topics, you know, like the history of Halloween, misconceptions, and things of that nature.
Very educational and entertaining.
And we've just started doing interviews with people from Hollywood and people from pop culture, such as Larry Hankin, which we just interviewed recently, who you know from Seinfeld and Friends and Billy Madison, among other things. So where can they find our podcast, Matt?
And they can find it at iHeartRadio, Apple Podcasts, Stitcher, and any other place that you can find podcasts on.
Just tune in and enjoy.